From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. Tomorrow marks 2 years since a former Juneau man was fatally shot by local police and Alaska State Troopers in Fairbanks. His family recently filed a wrongful death suit against the city of Fairbanks, the state, and the officers involved. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The suit alleges improperly trained officers used excessive force in what began as a welfare check on 20-year-old Cody Ayer, who was suicidal and carrying a handgun as he walked along the Steese Highway on the evening of December 24, 2017. Heavily armed Alaska State Troopers and police repeatedly told the distraught Ayer to drop his gun, but he refused, and the officers say they opened fire when Ayer pointed his gun toward them and made a verbal threat. A state inquiry found the officers' use of deadly force was lawful, but the Ayer family questions the self-investigation and blames police and troopers for escalating the situation. Cody Ayer's mother, Magdalena Ayer, says her father was a Fairbanks police officer and describes the family as pro-law enforcement, but says she can't come to terms with what happened.
This whole thing is just, you know, it's unbelievable. This is, sometimes I still want to just wake up.
Pointing to Alaska's high rates of depression and suicide, Magdalena Ayer holds up what happened to her son as evidence of a broader problem with how law enforcement deals with people experiencing a mental health crisis.
I pleaded with them to save my son, to save my baby. And they said, this is our number one concern right now. So this is how they treated their number one concern, with the SWAT team and without any non-lethal weapons.
Why did they not just give him some space?
Cody Ayer's dad, Kyle Ayer, says effecting a better approach is a primary goal of the family's lawsuit.
Until we can have this dialogue and both sides recognize that there's a problem, it's not going to go away. It's going to get worse.
The Ayers say they're working with lawmakers to advocate for better crisis intervention training for law enforcement.
To handle people that are depressed and under strain.
The Ayers say they've had minimal communication with the state and city, both of which declined to comment, citing the active lawsuit. City spokesperson Teal Soden read from a statement describing the shooting as a traumatic event that affects all involved.
While law enforcement officers have the duty to protect the public and the right to protect themselves, we understand the impact of events such as this and the loss experienced by Cody's family.
The Ayer civil suit is not seeking a specific amount of money, and the family downplays any potential financial gain.
Money is really more of a story pull or a gauge of the severity of the situation. I can tell you this. I would give you my very life or everything I have or ever would have if you could just give me my son.
What else is there?
Cody Ayer was Alaska Native, and his sister, Samantha Harrison of Juneau, is an Indigenous rights activist. She says her brother's experience is representative of a bigger issue.
People that are suffering a mental health emergency are 16 times more likely to be shot and killed in police encounters. And Alaska Native people have the highest rates of officer-related shootings. And so I think we're just trying to like step back and look at this whole situation, big picture, and not necessarily point blame at anyone, but really think about like, how can we fix this?
Harrison says she's using platforms like the Arctic Council and the UN to advocate for change. She's joining her family in Fairbanks for a Christmas Eve morning walk and rally in remembrance of Cody and a community Christmas Eve party Tuesday night.
You know, Cody was really struggling Christmas Eve, and so we wanted to create this space so that everyone had somewhere to be on Christmas Eve.
Harrison says the family has joined with those of others killed by police and the group Indigenous Lives Matter to put on the Christmas Eve gathering at the Chief David Salmon Tribal Hall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Federal prosecutors say a former Alaska juvenile justice official has been sentenced to 4 years in prison for possessing child pornography. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason on Monday sentenced 55-year-old Dennis Weston, who in October pleaded guilty to sexual exploitation of a child. Weston is the former deputy director of the State Department of Juvenile Justice, where he supervised McLaughlin Youth Center. Weston, in April 2017, responded to an online advertisement that referenced child exploitation topics. Prosecutors say he conducted a year-long dialogue with an undercover FBI agent. Investigators searched Weston's home and seized a computer that contained 22 images depicting child sexual exploitation. The state has completed a comprehensive update of its missing persons database. Missing Persons Clearinghouse Manager Malia Miller has spent 3 years working on the project.
Just trying to go through all the case files to get an update on how many we have and make sure they're currently listed as missing.
Miller says news of the update recently resulted in two individuals who went missing in the early 1970s being added to the list of over 1,200 dating back to just after statehood.
It's a repository for all missing persons in the state of Alaska, no matter what their circumstance is.
The earliest cases are five people who went missing on a boat trip on the Yukon River between the villages of Nilato and Ruby in 1960. The most high-profile missing persons on the list are Alaska U.S. Senator Nick Begich and Louisiana U.S. Representative Hale Boggs, who, along with an aide and a pilot, went missing on a flight between Anchorage and Juneau in 1972. Some missing persons cases are the result of murder or other foul play and cross over with the state's cold case database, which was also recently updated. Miller says human remains identified through dental records or more recently DNA can be a key to resolving missing persons cases.
Anytime there's unidentified remains found, they're put in the system as far as DNA goes or dental, and then as family members' DNA is put in, it's automatically searching against all the unidentified that are already in the system.
Solve some cases that way, and that's really good for the families to get some sort of closure.
Trooper spokesperson Ken Marsh points to two recent instances where DNA samples provided by a missing person's family enabled identification of remains. Ronald O'Quillick went missing from a special needs home in Palmer in 1987. 9 years later, 450 miles away in Central, some remains were found. Last spring, they were positively identified after his sister submitted a DNA sample.
We were able to get her to come in and provide some DNA, and it took about a year, but the lab eventually gets back with us and says, hey, the DNA that was provided actually matches the remains that were found in Central back in 1996.
DNA from a relative also aided in solving another case this past spring. Patrick Chambers went missing in 2006 while hunting near the Southeast Alaska community of Klawak. Marsh says a handgun found by surveyors over a decade later led to a nearby discovery of human remains, which were ID'd using DNA samples from Chambers' family. Marsh and Miller stressed that DNA samples must be collected by law enforcement and then processed at a lab in the University of North Texas, which handles all samples submitted for missing persons cases. Alaska emergency officials say at least six homes were evacuated after an ice jam caused a creek to flood in a subdivision north of Anchorage. Anchorage Daily News reported the Matanuska Susitna Borough Department of Emergency Services responded to flooding reports in Willow around 11 p.m. Saturday. No injuries were reported. The National Weather Service says ice jammed at a bridge and restricted normal water flow, causing upstream flooding. Residents near the Willow Creek and Deneki Road areas were evacuated late Saturday and early Sunday morning. Officials say the American Red Cross opened a temporary shelter. And Raven Air says it operated a normal afternoon schedule on Saturday after the company canceled about a half dozen morning flights in Alaska following what it called a malicious cyber attack. A Raven Air spokeswoman says the cancellations affected around 260 passengers. Raven Air says it canceled all flights involving its Dash 8 aircraft until noon because the cyber attack forced the company to disconnect the Dash 8 maintenance system and its backup. Pan Air flights and Raven Air Connect flights were still operating normally on backup systems. The company is working with the FBI, other authorities, and a cybersecurity company to restore systems. The precipitous drop in Gulf of Alaska cod recently closed the federal fishery for the upcoming season. Its effects are also being felt by processors who rely on the fish for their winter workload. The Trident Seafoods plant in Sand Point closed last month for the winter, leaving a gaping hole in the city's budget and leaving a lot of uncertainty about the future. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Kavitha George has this story.
The city of Sandpoint was founded on cod. Settled less than 150 years ago, it's had a processing plant in some form for nearly a century. This year is the first year that the plant, now owned by Trident Seafoods, won't be processing cod. And that's because of climate change.
It's no fault of the plant at Sandpoint. However, there's not enough fish to process. So the first time in my life, it's closed. And that's going to be pretty devastating to Sandpoint, and it'll hurt the other communities in our region, too.
That's Paul Gronholt, an Aleutians East Borough Assembly member, speaking at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting earlier this month. A massive marine heat wave known as the Blob began decimating Gulf cod stocks 5 years ago, and this year saw the lowest cod numbers on record. With so few fish to process, Trident closed the processing line on November 8th and notified the city in an email the same day, according to City Administrator Jordan Keeler. Trident declined a request for an interview. In a fishing town of just under 1,000, a large employer forced to close for 6 months is a huge blow. At peak seasons, the plant employs as many as 400 people. Keeler says many of them are out-of-town seasonal workers, however, so the biggest impact might not be unemployment, but rather the loss to the city's tax base.
We're looking at a significant loss of raw fish tax, as well as a loss of sales tax revenue because, the fleet isn't buying fuel, gear, paying for repairs of their boats.
In the months the plant is closed, Keeler estimates they'll lose half of their $600,000 sales tax budget and another 40% out of a raw fish tax budget of $400,000. Keeler says the city has a cash reserve it can use to fill in those holes, and they'll reevaluate in the spring. But he says the community will feel the loss regardless.
We expect to see a reduction in purchases at the store. That's for sure. How it impacts people buying airline tickets or buying consumer goods. I imagine that will be a decline. Just if there's less money, you have less money to spend.
The Trident plant processes salmon, halibut, and sable fish at various times of the year, but winters are mainly cod and pollock, brought in from Sandpoint's own fishing fleet, as well as boats as far away as Kodiak. For now, Keeler expects Sandpoint will just have to ride out the storm and hope for better conditions next year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Kavitha George in Kodiak.
Leaders of the remote Alaska community of Tuksuk Bay want to make it easier for residents to obtain real ID licenses. KYUK reports that the community on the coast of the Bering Sea is a $190 plane ticket from the nearest state division of motor vehicles office in Bethel. Because of the expense and inconvenience, the Tuksuk Bay City Council has voted to bring the DMV to residents. The city will schedule a visit from division representatives. Starting next October, Alaskans will need federally acceptable identification to board commercial airlines, access military bases, and enter federal facilities. And finally, Sitka is considering getting into the tiny home movement. The Daily Sitka Sentinel reports the Sitka Planning Commission got its first look last week at how city code could be amended to make room for tiny houses, specifically those on chassis, allowing the structures to be moved. At last week's meeting, the commission voted 3-2 to direct City Special Projects Manager Scott Berlinski to continue developing proposals on changing parts of the general code to define tiny houses and tiny houses on chassis. The idea is to allow them in mobile home parks and manufactured home parks. And here's a look at the National Weather Service forecast for the Juneau area. Tonight, widespread rain and snow showers, a little or no snow accumulation. Tuesday, rain and chance of snow, highs around 40. That's it for the KTOO News Update for Monday, December 23rd, 2019. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.